This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode 28. And thanks for listening. It's been a little while since we've released a podcast, so I want to apologize to you for that. But I took a little time off during the holidays, and I had the opportunity to go to Japan for a couple of weeks in December, and that was an amazing trip. If you ever get an opportunity, I highly recommend it. I had the chance to spend some time in Tokyo as well as Kyoto. And it was just an amazing trip and a lot of fun. But I'm ready. I'm back. I'm excited about 2017. Well, I have mixed emotions about 2017, but we'll get into that a little bit later during the podcast. But I have a major announcement. I wanted to let everybody know that there is now a Radical Therapist YouTube channel. So, and there's already a couple of videos up, and I would really appreciate it if you could find me. I hope you can find me. If you're looking for a link, just go to theradicaltherapist.com, and you can find a link to the YouTube channel there, or go to YouTube and just search my name, Chris Hoff, H-O-F-F, Chris Hoff, or Chris Hoff and the Radical Therapist, and it should come up, I hope. It being new, I don't know their YouTube's algorithms. I don't know how that all works, but hopefully eventually we'll start showing up on searches. But you can find it at theradicaltherapist.com website. I would really appreciate it if you found it, went and subscribed to it, and you know, maybe even left a comment, or if you like what you see, click like on the videos, and that would be awesome. I plan to have a lot of different kind of content on the YouTube channel. That'll be a work in progress. Not abandoning the podcast by any means. I'm excited about the podcast. We're going to be continuing to do regular podcasts, but I also just, I wasn't busy enough, I guess. I just wanted to throw some more work on my plate, but I really am excited about both the podcast and the YouTube channel as a way of delivering content that I hope you find useful, helpful, informative, and introducing new ideas. And I just kind of always I vision myself as a curator of ideas, and I hope you find them of value. So please go to the YouTube channel, click subscribe, like it, and I'm sure you're going to be hearing me talk a little bit about it more. I just put up a video on the five ways patriarchy affects men and their relationships, and that I hope you might find interesting. So that being said, let's get to the show. I'm excited. I brought the roundtable back together. We got Veronica Kuhn and Bryson Greaves and Lauren Foster all back together to just kind of have a conversation about we're titling this podcast, Let's Make Therapy Great Again, you know, just current issues in therapist training. And we're going to start our conversation talking about doing supervision in the time of Trump and then kind of move to some more pragmatic things. But I have gotten a lot of feedback from listeners about the roundtables, and they really appreciate them. A lot of students really appreciate these kinds of conversations about some of this stuff. And I've had multiple requests to bring the roundtable back, so we're making it happen. And I plan to do it more regularly, so just so you know. So let's get to it. Let's get to the show. Let's not wait any longer. And the roundtable is back. So let's go check in with Lauren, Veronica, and Bryson. Okay, we're back. It's been a long time. I got the therapist roundtable here with me. Very happy to have you all here. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
All right. So we can remind everybody who everybody is. If it'd be okay, I'll have you all introduce yourselves again before we get rolling. So who wants to start? Veronica.
Sure. I'm Veronica Kuhn, and I'm faculty at Texas Women's University in the Master's and Doctoral Family Therapy Program.
I am Lauren Foster. I am a fourth-year student at Loma Linda University in the Counseling and Family Sciences Department.
And I'm Bryson Greaves. I'm a private practice clinician at New Growth Counseling Services in Carlsbad, California, and also finishing up my fourth year of my doctorate with Lauren over at Loma Linda University.
Yes, and all colleagues of mine, and I'm really happy you're all here again and we can have some conversations. I get a lot of emails from folks, and we do have a lot of listeners who are grad students, master's level, and even doctoral level that are in training, and I have had multiple emails that they requesting we do another roundtable because they do like, you know, some of us are kind of really in the midst of a lot of these things, and they like listening in on these conversations. So thank you all for making yourselves available again. And you know, we're kind of calling this episode, you know, Make Therapy Great Again, just kind of exploring some current issues in therapist training. And I think we would, you know, we talked before, you know, hitting record, we talked a little bit about kind of doing supervision and supervision in the time of Trump, right? And so, and what some of those challenges might be or what we're going to be called to do. I actually got a recent email from a colleague at another site in LA that is confronting some of these issues as well, you know, integrating social justice into supervision. And so I just thought we would kind of start there and see how you're thinking about, because you're all doing supervision, how you're thinking about the next year and what some of the challenges might be.
Yeah, so I'm really interested right now as I head into the spring semester, my second semester at Texas Women's University. I'm teaching a really interesting combination of classes because I'm teaching a practicum class, which is students who are already in their placement sites, seeing clients, interfacing with communities of interest. And I'm also teaching a pre-practicum class, which is students who are getting ready to go out and launch into their first therapeutic experience. So I'm really thinking about supervision right now in both of those capacities. How do I bring social justice into both of those while also attending to some really basic needs that these students have in terms of just learning basic theory and principles and logistical things like developing a CV or a resume to get the placement site that they want and interviewing for them appropriately.
Right, which is we're going to actually talk about some of those topics too. But I think you really hit a point that not that we weren't doing it before, but it's really we're really being called to, you know, professionally train, but then theoretically train, mm-hmm. and then, you know, really attend to some of these social justice issues that are, you know, coming up. So
yeah, and feeling like that needs to happen earlier on, almost in the training process. At least I feel a call to really integrate that intentionally early on in the process, but also trying to be sensitive to that these students are learning so much all at one time and already feeling so overwhelmed, how to overlay that in a way that's supportive and not just one more overwhelming thing that they have to sort of take on and try to figure out and navigate.
Right. Lauren? Yeah.
I think for me, it's been a lot of students trying to sort of find themselves and be okay with whatever it is that they're feeling. And so I've had a number of students who I'm supervising who really are just trying to orient themselves in the room after the election and everything is happening there and feeling sort of out of sorts. And so a lot of our supervision has been around like, it's okay to feel whatever it is that you're feeling and to really, really want to do this work, but also knowing that it's okay to step back and do some self-care or be less involved in different aspects in social media because it can be very overwhelming, especially because we're sort of inundated with media and news all of the time. And that can feel particularly overwhelming when you're trying to care for the needs of others but not respecting your own needs at the time. So I think a lot of it has been me trying to help my students find whatever that balance looks like for them, while also being able to be their just natural human selves and bring that into the room versus having to sort of put on this mask or this hat of therapist and it completely ignore whatever it is that's happening for them at the time. So I think it's been just a lot of like the balancing act, particularly because I supervise really young women of color And so that is particularly important for them. Like, these are salient parts of their identity, and they're feeling like I have to sort of perform therapist rather than I can be myself and fill all of these things and still do a really good job of being a therapist and of being a helper. So I think that's what's come up a lot for them and for the students that I'm supervising.
Which is great. And we're going to talk more about kind of how you do that or how you do transparency in a bit. But before we do that, let me get to Bryson. What are some of the challenges you foresee, Bryson?
Yeah, I can really relate to the balance that both I think Lauren and Veronica are talking about. I think for me, I've found the balance to sort of apply to something slightly different, where I think we're in a pretty, an upheaval, and there was so much energy around the election and on both sides, and it really felt split in a lot of ways. And so naturally there are students in our field who feel strongly one way or another, and that's part of who they are and what they're bringing in. And like Lauren said, to help them be able to sort of be accepting of that part of themselves, and figure out how they can show up in the room authentically. And I sort of have that balanced against this idea of countertransference that we're always dealing with as therapists, and whether or not this is another example that's heightened by just how much media coverage and everything else there is of when therapists can be pulled into countertransference. And in honor of transparency, I really don't know for myself yet where I sit with this in terms of supervising students around helping them to look at countertransference and the parts of themselves that might be getting activated and why and how that shows up in the therapy room, versus helping them or me being supportive and validating their experiences. Maybe if it's like, for example, they're having a really difficult time with the election of Donald Trump, you know, how much of that do we validate and sit with and be with our supervisees, and so that they can be with clients, and how much of that allows for a conversation about transference and countertransference, I think is really for me what I view as my potential biggest hurdle in supervising students currently.
Yeah, and you raised a point, and I think Veronica wanted to touch on this earlier, this idea that we are still all trying to just figure this out, right? And we reserve the right to change our mind at any time, right? but it's certainly in process. So,
I was also thinking, Chris, as Lauren and Bryson were talking, was also just recognizing the impact that the election had on me personally, and in the idea of countertransference, that for some of my students, they said, like, this election wasn't a big deal. I didn't pay attention to it. I don't feel impacted by it. And as a supervisor, I also got to sit with that. Like, is there something I do in that moment, or is that my stuff that I get to work on personally, about my process or experience of the election? Or is this something that we need to talk about with the student or whatever it is? How much of that countertransference is also my own? Like, it's not just the student supervisee working through that, but also us as supervisors working through that.
Well, it's true. I'm sure there's going to be listeners to the show that we're actually pro Trump, right? And therapists, mm-hmm. and you know, and how do we make room or space for all of that, even though mm-hmm. maybe, you know, philosophically and ethically, you know, we're struggling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe, you know, this episode is about training, and I'm trying to figure out where we should start, because you guys all touched a little bit on this transparency thing. So maybe we start there, and then we'll get into the kind of the nuts and bolts of finding a practicum and what happens in the beginning. And we're going to talk a little bit about doing co-therapy, which is coming up actually at my site as well too. So but this idea of in doing transparency, because I think in training, I don't know about your training, but in my training, and I call it now, there's like some mythology that gets passed through like psychology training programs, right? That that there is no self-disclosure, and I kind of try to trace that history, and I think it goes back to a particular model, right? But then has become propagated across all models, and we're still kind of in a model-focused world. I think there's a call, at least for a lot of the people that I supervise and kind of sit with, that of wanting to be more transparent. And I think the way that I've talked about it in the past with my supervisees, and the way that I kind of quickly, I'll give you my elevator pitch, is that with our clients, there's a center to every conversation, right? And a lot of times the people that consult us will ask us to step into that center. And I think it's important that we do that. And I know a lot of people might disagree with that, but I think it's important we do that. We just don't camp out in the center, right? And that's kind of how my quick, in a nutshell, approach this kind of idea of transparency. Now, there's a lot of nuance and complexity to all of that, and it's a case, kind of case-by-case basis. But how do all of you kind of begin, especially in this time too, how do you begin to talk about how you do, like, either authentic self or transparency or some of these things that gets called?
I don't mind sharing to start. I try and often simplify things, I think, especially with students, to give them little marker points. So for me, I think of three terms when I'm feeling that time to be maybe more disclosing about something about myself in therapy. I think about function, timing, and relevance. So the function being, what is my purpose if I'm going to disclose something? What is my purpose? What is the function I'm trying to achieve? Is that to validate somebody's experience? Is that to propose a suggestion? But what is the function? The timing of it, is it an appropriate time, like you said, Chris, to shift the center of the conversation maybe more away from the client and more toward therapist, or even if there is ever a great time to do that. But considering timing, when a client is in a deep exploration of their own experience and you've worked with them through that, it may not present a great time to just start disclosing something about a time in which you maybe had a similar experience. And then the relevance, is it relevant to both the overall goals of therapy that's been collaborated on between client and therapist, and is it relevant to the current process that the therapist and client are both working on together? I think for me, that's a way I orient myself and really do a check and balance with myself before I choose to sort of just talk about some part of myself that just may not be the great time to do that.
Sure. Lauren?
Yeah, so I completely agree, Bryson. I would be very curious sort of as to why some therapists or some of my like trainees are wanting to share. So is it that I don't know what else to say right now, or I'm feeling so raw about what's happening that's just what I'm feeling and that's sort of what I need to sort of fill the space. I think that goes to like, what's the function of this thing, right? Is it like a genuine visceral reaction to something and you don't know how else to name that thing? Mm-hmm. So is that why you're sort of being transparent in that moment? And I think sometimes, so from my own master's training, I did a lot of person of the therapist work. And so in that work, you are going to have reactions for one reason or another. And it's up to you as a therapist to sort through what's happening for you in the moment. And then to use that, to inform whatever it is that you're going to do next. So it's not necessarily, I'm having this reaction and now I'm going to be completely transparent and tell you my whole life story, but it's like, this is the reaction I'm having. Why am I having this? And is my reaction something that could be useful to my client? So I'm not necessarily saying to a client of mine, like, you know what, that story that you just told me pissed me off, right? But like, I would wonder how you make it, like others interact with you when you say that sort of thing, or I would wonder how other people are feeling, because right now I'm feeling pretty attacked and I'm feeling da da da. And so I think that you can be very transparent about who you are and sort of what you're feeling in the moment. But I think it has to, sort of what Bryson was saying, it has to have a purpose. But I also think that you get to sort of honor yourself and honor who you are in the room at the same time. So if it is sort of a situation where you are feeling attacked or you're feeling overwhelmed, I think there is space for you to be able to say that as a therapist. Like, you get to sort of be yourself in the room and to name that thing, because there also comes a point where if I'm not going to be transparent, that the work probably won't be really productive. If I can't be my genuine self, and if I can't tell you, like, okay, we're in this relationship together, but I can't tell you what's going on for me, I don't know how effective that is all of the time. And granted, a lot of the time it's stuff that I need to deal with, but if I'm often feeling something and I'm not naming that thing, I don't know how effective therapy can be.
Veronica.
Yeah. Authenticity in therapy and self-disclosure. For me, I feel like those are sort of two different things and they go together, but I don't know. I think I can be authentic without self-disclosing. And I think sometimes I can self-disclose without being authentic, which is sort of an interesting thing. But I think a lot about in my early years as a clinician, I had the opportunity to attend a training with Marsha Linehan when I was like learning DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. And they were talking about therapy interfering behavior and that there were things therapists could do that would interfere with the relationship or the therapeutic relationship or the therapeutic process. And one of them was sort of around boundaries and self-disclosure and not checking in with yourself about where you were in your sort of current life state and how that might change how you self-disclose or when you self-disclose. And I still draw on that a lot, sort of especially having now had two children and seeing how my life has changed, experiencing things that were very obvious to the outside world, like being pregnant, but that were very personal to me that I didn't want to talk about, and making choices not to self-disclose or not to share or not to talk a lot about those parts. Even though they were pretty obvious and people felt like they had a right to ask me those sorts of questions. I think a lot about that idea around boundaries and around checking in with myself about, like, how do I feel about sharing with this? And so I try to carry that through in my supervision, too, when I'm talking to students. Like, what is it like for you? Have you checked in with yourself about where you are in your life right now? Are there things going on in your life that you don't want to disclose to your clients or that wouldn't feel safe disclosing, but that you're thinking about that we can talk about here to see how maybe those experiences can be used to inform the therapeutic process without necessarily exposing too much of yourself or exposing parts of yourself that you don't want to share, or don't feel comfortable sharing with your clients. And then I also think about an acronym that a colleague told me a while back, which is WAIT. And it's why am I talking right now? Or why am I talking? And so a lot of times I'll ask when supervisees bring video in and they're like, I feel like I was talking for too long. I said, I'll like reflect that. So like, let's go through WAIT. Like, when we watch this clip, can you go back to that moment and think about like, why were you talking in that moment? And I think that really hits on some of the stuff that Bryson was talking about. What was the function? What was the timing? What was the relevance? And then how do you think that worked out? How do you think it played out with your client? Do you think it was useful when we watch the video back? Can we look at their response? Do you think it was a positive therapeutic response, or do you think that maybe it missed the mark? What would you do differently next time? If that was something you wanted to share, how could you share it in a way that maybe was slightly different so that it could improve the therapeutic process instead of maybe taking it off track? So those are the things that I think about in terms of being authentic and about self-disclosure in therapy. At least that's where I'm at right now, but I'm sure that will change.
I really like what you said there, Veronica, because I was thinking about how I do this, like with students, not just as a clinician. And I really like that idea. And I think when you can go through that with a student, sort of the checklist of let's talk through the function and the purpose, the timing, and the relevance, you know. And I think there's a way, both as the clinician, to do that in real time to sort of help them decipher if this is a good time or not. But upon reflection, to grow and develop our practice or to be working with trainees, that this gives them an opportunity to sort of arrive at maybe some of their own answers to their own questions about why was it happening? Was it useful or not useful to the client? How do they know? So I really like that. I think maybe that's something I'll try and do more of.
And does anybody want to take on like how you're doing the social justice piece, how you're supervising that when it comes up, and maybe something, maybe a situation that has come up, or and how you, you know, how are you helping people do social justice?
So I've had two really unique experiences supervising individuals who are relatively new to the profession, new to therapy, and even new to maybe challenging issues or ideas of social justice, or bringing a social justice perspective to their work. And then I also, at the exact same time, paralleling that experience, had the opportunity to work with doctoral level students who had a bit more experience doing this. And I think how I approached both of those were really different because of the context. I think when working with the doctoral students, I found myself maybe walking into that middle of the circle that you were talking about, Chris, and talking about my own personal experience, trying to navigate some of these social justice issues. Following the election, I talked about my own uncertainty of, like, how do I talk about this? I don't know where I'm at in terms of reflecting about the impact of the election on my own personal experience. And I felt a little uneasy guiding or leading a conversation, a process conversation around that. But I did want to make space. And so sort of being really authentic and transparent about, like, I don't know what I'm doing in this space, but I think that there needs to be some conversation, or I want to create some space for this conversation because that feels really relevant. And I felt like that was pretty well received. And I really left it up to the group to sort of facilitate that conversation among themselves. And then I did interject a few times if I had concern about, like, safety of the group or people being silenced in any way. I would sort of navigate in that way. On the flip side, working with individuals who are more novice, I found I was doing a lot of psychoeducation. So providing articles, talking about, you know, how their clients might experience this, asking them to bring in cases of where their client might have brought something up that maybe was connected to the election. And a lot of clients of my students were bringing up the election, and yet that wasn't being addressed in the presentations in class until I started asking the question, like, oh, did you check in with that? Like, what date was this session that you saw the client? Like, how were they? Were they different than other sessions? And that's when I started hearing more of the stories of clients being fearful about being deported, or children being concerned about their parents being deported. Right. And then having a conversation around that. So how do you think that ties into what's going on sort of in the larger society with the recent election? How do you feel comfortable navigating those conversations? What is this like for you? Hearing your client talk about that, do you have some stories about how you talk about politics? So some of my students said, you know, I was taught not to talk about politics at the dinner table, and somehow therapy can feel a bit like the dinner table, right? Like, yeah, we don't talk about it there. And so then how do I maybe challenge that to encourage them to bring it up because it seemed relevant to the client? And then also, how do I let them sit with maybe you don't bring it up in this moment, but also staying aware of how it might be impacting the client, so that you can be attuned if it does come up in the future.
Right. Anybody else?
Oh, come on, you guys, take some risks with me.
I'll share a risk.
I don't want to be the only one on the watch list.
And it was more of a risk of maybe I'm going to ask you about your, because it came up in I have group supervision this week. At my agency, it came up that one of a younger woman, female, woman of color, spoke of, and I was really appreciated that she was able to put this out there, her hesitancy around seeing white men. And then we got to have an a conversation about me being, you know, a white male supervisor and being her supervisor. And she was really honest with me in the beginning about, you know, being kind of apprehensive and anxious and not knowing how that's going to go. So we had a nice conversation about that, but it was just kind of the beginning stages of that conversation. And I'm kind of, you know, so my thoughts now are like, you know, how do I continue that conversation? Keep it a safe place, continue that conversation, and not really seeking something to be resolved, but how do I be supportive through that process, right? And quite honestly, I don't have the answer right now. I'm kind of sorting it out, but if anybody has any input for me, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I don't know that it's input, but or maybe the audience has input that we'll get some feedback from. But as you were talking, I started thinking, you know, it seems to me like the more I sort of do this work, that communication is really just the constant balance of competing perception. I mean, whether it's rooted in past experience, current experience, biases of some kind, or just feelings or desires of any kind, that two people communicate, they often have two different ideas, two different value sets. They bring in different things to that conversation. There are two competing perceptions. And I think from what you're talking about, Chris, and what you found helpful, and I think in my work, what I've also found helpful is keeping that space open, having some awareness of my own sort of sociopolitical location, yeah, and gender and privilege and male whiteness, and to be able to not sort of hide behind that, but expose and talk about it, and I think has been something that I have found to be helpful. And yet, at the other end, there are people who probably may identify the same gender or Caucasian or whatever as I do, and they could have a totally different experience about Donald Trump or preference toward him or toward this. So it's sort of like, how do we all come to the table and discuss this in this setting without alienating any voice, right? I mean, social justice in some regard is about not silencing voices. That doesn't mean we would have to agree with what that voice says, but on some level, we have to acknowledge that that voice exists. It could be different from ours, and we do have to talk about it. So I think for me, it's almost been more difficult creating the space for the other side of the coin, who is, you know, the very conservative, very kind of just open to sort of like really enjoying all this stuff that's going on with the election, and it feels like it's shutting down diversity in some ways. That's hard as a therapist, I think, to really sit with clients or with supervisees at the moment who are holding that when that position is also creating a lot of pain on the other side of the aisle. So it is a tough to balance those conversations, but I think that's really what we're doing. I don't know that there's a solution, rather than creating an openness and a balance point to bring all the voices to the table.
And I sort of think to Chris's, I guess, open-ended question, in my experience with particularly white male supervisors, I found that the best supervisors that I've had, that I've actually been the most open with, are the ones that sort of come in and like don't, I guess, tout themselves as necessarily experts about everything. And I think that's what I've appreciated the most. And that's when I've eventually come into like being very authentic and can be very exposed about whatever my experiences have been. And they've also been very curious about who I am, and have not necessarily seen me as just like, right, it's just like a black woman, and know that that's a part of my experience, but that's not sort of who I am in totality. But to not also ignore that part of myself. So I think just remaining open and remaining curious, especially at this time, is absolutely necessary for any sort of supervisory or therapeutic work that we're going to be doing, and not making these very broad general assumptions about who people are and sort of how they come in. Right. But being really open and being really, really curious, even if we really feel like we've got it figured out, there are going to be people we come into contact with where it's like, well, I didn't expect that out of you. And to be genuinely curious about that once we find those things out. So I think that's one of the ways that we continue to do therapy and to continue to do supervision at this point in time, is just to be very curious and to be very open. And it's difficult to do, for sure, but I think that's got to be one of the ways that we make really good therapeutic work happen.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think I've said more often than not, I've said to my students, like, this seems like something that's really important, and I'm not sure that this conversation is over at the end of today. So if it's okay, I'm going to bring this up as we continue to work together. Like, I am frequently saying, like, this feels really important. And I've even had students that felt like it wasn't important, but as a supervisor, I felt like it was important and how it was impacting clients. And so I've maybe drawn a bit more firmer line and said, I think that this is really important for these reasons. And I'm going to keep bringing this up because I think it's something that we need to continue to address. And I hope that we can continue to reflect on it. And most students have been pretty open to it. And some of them haven't been open to it. And I still keep bringing it up because I think it's really important because of the specific issue. I felt like it was really important, especially for the marginalized populations that they were working with, that it could be reinforcing of that marginalized position. And I didn't want to perpetuate that as a supervisor by letting the issue go because the student didn't think it was important or didn't see the importance of it.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up on that a little bit, because we're all talking about how as supervisors we would bring this up, and I'm in this moment keenly aware that we have a lot of students listening to us. So my plea to them would be, I want to validate for them that it is totally normal to be affected by something your client says, does, feels, experiences, and that it is okay to talk about it. My bias is it's a better thing to talk about it, to not feel ashamed that you have a reaction as a therapist to something that a client says. And I would want to encourage all of them to challenge their supervisors. I love being challenged by my supervisees when they feel like either I said something that sparked a reaction in them, and then we talk about it. So I think what I want students to also know that a lot of supervisors are totally open to those people coming up and talking to us about it. I think it's a good thing.
True, Bryson, but we also have to acknowledge there's a lot that aren't.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
That might be true too.
And you can find yourself in some power operations that aren't great.
I know in some of my work over the past 6 months or so, I've found myself having a lot of anxiety as a supervisor, bringing some of this stuff up, not knowing how it lands, feeling sort of like physiological responses in the room with my supervisees, feeling nervous, feeling like tightness, feeling almost like jittery sometimes because I'm so nervous about like, am I going to say something wrong? Am I going to offend them? Am I bringing up something that maybe isn't important to them that's important to me? Navigating all those things can feel anxiety provoking for me, can feel nervous for me. And I'm oftentimes transparent with my supervisees about that because I think having sat on the other side as a supervisee, I've been really nervous when my supervisors bring it up because I don't know how to respond, or maybe I had never thought about that before, or maybe I realized that I was doing something that was marginalizing a client unintentionally, and that can feel really not so great. And so I try to acknowledge that these are all, I think no matter where you sit, can be really challenging, more challenging for some than others because of the different power that some might hold, like as a supervisor, but that these are difficult conversations, and sometimes they don't feel so great when you're stepping into that zone of uncertainty, when you're stepping out of your discomfort. And yet I think those are the places that we get to stand in right now, in some of that discomfort, to see what can come out of those conversations.
Yeah, great. Okay, so moving on, we are going to do some practicality stuff, I think, we plan to talk about. And I have, at our agency, I got 5 new trainees starting next week, so it's another kind of time to, as we're bringing new people in. But one of the things we were going to talk about was kind of finding, and I'm doing a training actually next week, so I'm throwing this one on you. I didn't talk about this with you guys before, but I'm doing a training on first sessions next week, so hold that thought. But I was thinking, like, but my phone's been ringing for people, and I don't know what it's like. Well, I do. You were in Southern California. Well, two of you are in Southern California. One of you is in Texas. But practicum sites are hard to come by. And so it's getting more and more competitive. I don't know. There's in Orange County where I'm at, Orange County, California. There's several MFT programs, right? And so it's getting more and more competitive. My phone rings a lot for people looking for sites. What do you recommend? How do you talk to students? How do you direct them or help them or guide them into finding practicum sites? Or how do you counsel them on that process?
So this is sort of new territory for me because in my master's program, we didn't have to find sites per se. The university had all the sites and we just went and interviewed at them and we were matched sort of like in a physician matching sort of way, a residency matching sort of way. So I was very lucky that I didn't have to go through this, but I've had the opportunity to support students through this. And a lot of times the first thing I talk to them about is networking. Start talking to people who are at placement sites that use a theory that you've been drawn to or that are with a population that you're interested in or who are doing work that you think you might want to do. If you want to work with couples, if you want to work with veterans, if you want to do narrative therapy or be a narrative therapist, if you want any of these sort of specific things, start talking to those people who are in those places to start networking. And that's my advice also for students who are about to graduate who are looking for jobs, that networking is sort of like the platform that you can jump off of and that sort of opens doors in some way. So that's usually where I start. Yeah.
Well, which I think is great. I'm going to just really quick. I think that's great advice. The people that at California Family Institute, the people that typically end up as trainees there are people that have reached out to me previous, have maybe attended a training even before practicum. But what I get a lot of, and this is maybe for the students or they're going to be doing practicum soon that are listening, I get a lot of emails and phone calls, and they don't really know anything about the site or we're kind of a postmodern narrative place, and there's just kind of not an understanding of that, like they hadn't done the research. But then the people that reach out and say, I'm really interested in the work that you're doing, or they've attended a training, those kinds of things, they really stand out, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's sort of a drought in placement sites, and I think sometimes people will just cast their net really far and wide, and that comes through in the communication that they send to the placement site.
Right.
Yeah, I don't really disagree with anything that you guys are talking about. In fact, I certainly agree. I do think sometimes practicum students, and I'll share my own experience, feel like for whatever reason they have a pull toward a particular client, and there's probably very good reason for that. And if that's what they imagine wanting to work with, I just think a level of openness to other things is also key when looking for a practicum site, because in truth, people are coming in, they don't have clinical experience. That's why they're doing these things. So it would be very hard from an experiential point of view to actually know what you want to work with or what you like working with or what you don't like working with. My experience, I went to the same university as Veronica for my master's where it was matching. I went in wholeheartedly believing I wanted to work with substance abuse and dependency issues, and primarily with adolescents. I had done that a little bit prior going in, and I just sort of thought that's what I was wanting to do. I toured a lot of sites. I went to these different sites that were available to us to sort of get matched with. I ended up getting placed at the VA, at the Veterans Affairs, where we did almost all couple therapy and co-therapy. I was terrified of couple therapy. I had my own experiences, and I was like, boy, this is really tough. I don't think my experience of being worried about working with couples is all that different from people when they're starting out. I think a lot of us share with that. And now I predominantly see couples. I love working with couples. It's like my favorite thing to do. And I've spent a lot of time training in it. I get to teach couple therapy. I would have probably had no idea ever, or at least it would have taken many more years to discover that within myself had I not been open to this, you know, change in sort of philosophy of who I wanted to work with. So I think students should try and go to as many sites as they can if they have open houses. I think, like Chris said, learn about the site, be able to talk about each site. Don't sort of phone it in when you get there, and know something about the site, what they do. And like Veronica said, I think pursuing an interest or starting to develop an interest in what kind of clients you want to work with is wonderful, but don't limit yourself to one thing and then sort of only try and find sites that deliver on those, deliver to that population. That's limiting a big aspect of the experience.
Yeah. So I would agree with what you've both said. I have that written down in my notes. But I would also say, in terms of openness, sort of being able to be open about what it is that you want out of a particular practicum experience, but not being so open where you may go and work with adolescents, then it's like, I am absolutely miserable here and I hate this. So if there are certain things that you know sort of going out of the gate, like, I don't really think that this is my area, or I've had students who maybe they would struggle working with addictions because they have some sort of familial ties around those things, and they may want to work through some of that in therapy out prior to. And so for some people, that they may take that challenge on and be able to work well with it, but sort of gauging where you're at before you go in and knowing like, okay, this may be a challenge for me. I may seek other sort of therapeutic experiences or sort of seek therapy in the process, but still remaining open to different client populations as well. And I would also add, like, thinking about how change occurs. So I think with some of my newer students, asking them like, okay, so how do you think change happens? Like, just generally speaking. And I had one student talk about her experiences with group therapy and how just absolutely enriching that was. And she really believes in the power of group therapy. So I was like, well, maybe look for a site that does some group therapy, because you feel like that's sort of the crux of how good work happens, is when it happens in terms of a process and one person's facilitating and everybody gets to contribute to that. And so for her, she was able to find a site that does have a number of groups that happen, but it's a community-based setting. And so for her, that was a good fit because group therapy is such a big part of her own experience and how therapy works and her own beliefs of how change works. So I would also say that, like, thinking around, like, how do you really believe change happens? Like, if you have previous experiences with therapy or just in learning about different models, like, what do you really believe in terms of change? And maybe looking for that in terms of practicum sites.
Okay. So then the next point, I think I'm going to go to one of the common practices when you're starting at a site and starting to see clients, before I get into individual, maybe first sessions, is let's talk a little bit about co-therapy. You brought it up a little bit, Bryson. That one of the common practices in sites, we're not doing this at California Family Institute currently, but I think there has been some talk about doing some more co-therapy. But one of the common practices is when you're starting, you do usually hook up with somebody that's a little bit more senior and you do some co-therapy to begin the process. And I know there's a lot of questions around, at least I've started to experience them, all of you have spoken about it too. There's a lot of question about how do you do co-therapy? And I've actually had the opportunity to do co-therapy with Veronica, so this is interesting. But you know, how do you talk about it? How do you kind of begin to instruct somebody? Because one of the common questions is, what's the back and forth going to be like? When do I know when to talk and when not to talk and this kind of thing? And so it's kind of really logistical in some ways. And there's a lot of not knowing what to expect. So how do you prepare your trainees for co-therapy?
I think that's one of the things that I've struggled with, is that I had students who weren't prepared to work in co-therapy, in a co-therapy model. And so they just showed up with another therapist at the time of the session and jumped in. And then they were showing me these videos of like, this was really awkward. Is this what co-therapy is about? I don't like this. And so it was really an interesting experience for me. Because then it was sort of like, okay, how did we go back and sort of have a conversation that, in my opinion, should have happened before co-therapy even started. So I really think it's important that the two therapists meet, discuss the case, make sure that there's some compatibility between the therapists. Not everybody works well together, and that's okay. But to be able to know that you can sort of connect and reflect and have really transparent conversations about the therapeutic process. And, you know, I felt like you were interrupting me a lot in that session, or I felt like you were silencing me, those sorts of things. You need to be able to have some sort of safety in the relationship to be able to talk about those things. And so talking about ideas around theories of change, what theoretical model you're going to use in the therapeutic process, that doesn't mean that it has to be the same theory. Chris, you and I don't work from the same model of therapy, but that didn't hurt or impact our therapeutic relationship with the client in any way. But it did mean that we got to be transparent about like how we were viewing how change was happening and how we were being informed by the model that we were using to make sure that therapy was congruent from session to session and between the therapists.
Right.
And I think sort of to Veronica's point, I think you always have to think about that co-therapy relationship is always going to be evolving. So being able to have that safety and that relationship is really crucial. So if at this point, maybe we're using more of your model rather than mine, that's fine. But we can sort of have that open dialogue about what's happening within our own relationship and then being very transparent about that, I think, in the room so that we can work effectively and even asking each other in the room, like, so what do you think is happening right now, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that sort of works, but just knowing that that relationship is going to change like any relationship would over time. But you and your co-therapist both being very open to that idea of like, this is a change process and this very much is a relationship. And there are some days where we're going to have like, we're going to be on time and like on top of it. And there are some days where we just might miss each other for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But being able to ride that wave and being able to talk through some of those days where it's like, I feel like that was really off what was going on today. I think that's a really helpful thing with the whole cold therapy process.
Well, and I think that ties so much back into the conversation we were having earlier about like transparency and authenticity, mm-hmm. right? That you sort of have to be able to be in touch with those things to be able to then bring voice to them in the co-therapy relationship, whether that be in session with clients, sort of in real time or at the end or before the session happens, to be able to reflect to your co-therapist.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you, this idea of, and I didn't really think about it that way because I know some people that have had some really bad experiences in co-therapy. My personal experiences in co-therapy have always been, I've really enjoyed it. And maybe I'm just blind to maybe the other person's struggling. I don't know. But even the first time I ever did therapy was such an impactful experience with me. And it was a co-therapist. And I still feel such fondness for the other therapist that invited me into the room for my first therapy session. And I just have always had good experiences. But when I've seen it not work and I've seen it not work, it's usually around these differences that the co-therapists get into, and they end up really struggling relationally between the two of them.
Yeah, I think I'm probably just echoing a lot of what you all have said in terms of how I think about co-therapy. I'll get to that. But I spent a lot of, well, almost my whole career to this point, I've never gone a year without doing co-therapy. I've never gone. So in my practicum site, when I was at the VA, I did probably 3/4 of my work in couple therapy or family therapy with co-therapists. And I had a range. I think we had 4 or 5 different ones, but I had one in particular that I worked with the entire year from start to finish. Every case that we saw together, we saw probably somewhere between 4 and 5 cases a day together in co-therapy. So that was really neat. So what I learned from that was it's an evolving relationship. So I would encourage people who are in co-therapy to consider it over time as an evolving relationship, and to sort of not jump ship too early on.
Right.
There's ebbs and flows of when you're on the same page, when you're not on the same page. My sort of take home list, number one, is it's a relationship. Think about it like a relationship with your co-therapist. It needs trust and openness and honesty, empathy. You'll challenge each other. You'll agree with each other. Talk to each other like Veronica and Lauren had said, both before and after sessions, but maybe more importantly, knowing that you can turn to your therapist, your co-therapist in session, that two co-therapists talking together has a lot of power in how helpful that can be in a therapeutic process. So if one therapist is getting lost, to be able to turn to your co-therapist and say, you know, I'm feeling a little lost right now. I'm wondering if your read on what we're doing right now is different than mine. Can I check in with you? Being able to model between co-therapists, there's a lot of really good strengths I think the co-therapy model provides. Thirdly, review your work together. If at all possible, review tapes together as co-therapists. My co-therapist and I, I'm still doing this now to this day. I have one case a week that I see in co-therapy. I've been seeing it for 3 years. We watch our tapes all the time. We film almost every session. We did at the VA, and my co-therapist and I would get together and watch our sessions, sort of a debriefing of what I was doing here and how did she have somewhere else she was thinking? How did we sort of miss each other in that moment? But sort of playing Monday morning quarterback gave us a depth to our work that I don't think we would have had if we didn't get that opportunity. So I'm letting my bias of co-therapy come through. I like it. It's a good model. I have lifelong friendships with colleagues that I just absolutely love and adore as a result, and I feel really fortunate about it. I know not all experiences are wonderful in co-therapy. It can be a challenge, but on the whole, it's been terrific.
Yeah, agreed. All right, before I let you all go, for the sake of time, I'm going to ask you to help me out this week since I got to do a training on first sessions. So what is your best advice or even like counsel or what have you when you're prepping your supervisees to enter into a first session?
I think I just always invite them to have a plan. Like, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I guess it does matter what the plan is, but like to have some sort of plan other than just the intake packet.
Do you help with initial questions, or do you have a favorite kind of line of inquiry to begin sessions with? Or
I really try to adapt it to like the presenting problem, the presenting system. So I don't have like one formal process, which I guess is why I tell my students or try to support them in developing a plan, because I think it does change and gets to be adapted. There are certain things that I always do. I come from definitely a more biomedical model, so I always ask about sort of presenting problem, not necessarily presenting pathology, but presenting problem, whatever that might be within the system. And what the system has tried to do to fix it, what's worked, what hasn't worked, those sorts of questions. But then I also have like more standard like couples protocol when I'm doing couples therapy that I follow.
Anybody else? Lauren?
So, I mean, absolutely covering, you know, all the good legal stuff at the front. Just letting them know like these... I'm a manager,
all that reporter, stuff.
All of that great stuff, covering and like I have to. So at our particular master's program, they have to video record themselves. So like throwing that in at the front, letting them know why. Sort of, I have these supervisors that are working with me, making sure that you get the best care, the best level of care you can. And then after that, I think most of my supervisees just sort of get into it by asking like what brought them there today, how things have been changing. Very SOPT, I think they start off for the most part. And then also letting their clients know that if they're feeling really sort of emotionally spent at the end, or if they're feeling pretty embarrassed by everything that's just come out of their mouths, that's sometimes very normal and it's okay to feel that way, but to come back again for the next session and to talk a little bit about like vulnerability hangovers and those sorts of things, because sometimes like it just comes out all of a sudden for some of our clients, and then they don't want to see us again the next session because it's just like, I can't believe I've told this stranger everything about myself, right? And then to just explain, like, it's perfectly normal. Like, I see clients all the time. That's not going to chase me away. I'm still going to be here for you. And so please come back. And that's totally fine that, you know, you just had sort of this sort of emotional word vomit sort of situation. But other than that, going at the first session, I think you just ask, cover all the legal questions, ask anything about any sort of medical issues as they arise, if you need to know that. But just figuring out what it is that's bringing them in there. And I think going from there, depending on what the client is coming up with.
I will say, sorry, really quick, just to chime in, Bryson, I don't mean to cut you off, but I do try in that first step, in that first session, to instill some sort of hope. Mm-hmm. So even if there is some problem talk going on, also trying to find client strengths in a really like genuine and authentic way. I worked in community mental health, and it was like a line on like the county intake forms, and it would sort of be like, oh, what are your strengths? You know, but like clients can't always find that when they come in for therapy in that moment. And so really being like genuine and authentic and listening in a way that you can reflect strengths to the client to make them feel hopeful about like the change process, but also that you're listening and connected to them, and that maybe you're seeing parts of them that they haven't seen in a while, or that maybe others haven't seen in a while or have ever seen, I think is really important in that first session.
Yeah. A very wise mentor of mine told me, I'll never forget it. Plan A, have a plan. Plan B, forget the plan. That's your
live
by code as a therapist, I guess, in some ways. So my plan, like everybody else, and especially for students out there, to know what needs to be in the informed consent in a first session. And that isn't just what people are signing. People can sign a document and not actually give informed consent because they don't understand that document. So I think students at their placement site and clinicians all around have to sort of due diligence in helping people to understand the documents that they're signing. So I usually will start there. So things like fees, reporting, confidentiality, privacy, anything that's like particular to the site, maybe it's videotaping or something like that. I really want to let people in on that. But from the outset, I am really working on creating collaboration, openness, and safety. So almost everything that I am saying to folks in the first session, I'll ask them their thoughts and feelings about it. You know, how is it for you to consider being filmed? Should we talk about that? One question I always ask is, have they ever been to therapy before? Family therapy, individual therapy, met with a psychologist, psychiatry. I want to know, you know, if there's other providers that I should be collaborating with. But two, I want to know what they found helpful and what they didn't find helpful. And I will say, you know, if they've had a really bad experience with therapy, I'll say, well, you know, talk to me about what that was. Help me to not be that guy for you, right? Help me to not be that therapist for you. What did you feel like that experience was? How did that happen? And vice versa, if they found it really helpful, maybe they were sort of doing mindfulness techniques every third session or something like that, that the client found like particularly really helpful. They may not write that down on a questionnaire. And if I'm not asking about their positive and negative experiences of past therapy, I may never know that and miss something that the client found really, really helpful. So asking about previous therapy experiences is usually something I always do. And then I'm pretty, like I said, plan A and plan B. But if plan A goes according to plan, I'm usually pretty open and just say, you know, help me get a little understanding of how things have been for you and what it is that you feel like is going to be meaningful for us to talk about today and moving forward. Because I think that's something in therapy. We're always working on present process, but trajectory moving forward. So I usually ask them that question and then join and validate. I say one other thing?
Of course.
Because I feel like students have told me this so many times, and I feel this too sometimes, that they can often feel so much pressure, even in that first session, or maybe even before the first session, to start fixing stuff.
Right.
My general feedback to clients, to supervisees, is don't fix anything in the first session. Don't put that pressure on yourself. Unhinge yourself from that. If there's a crisis, we'll manage the crisis. But don't feel like you have to go try and change, you know, all this stuff in an hour. That's a lot of pressure to put on yourself. And in truth, it blocks you from probably joining folks where they need to be joined at.
Well, you raise a point because we've been talking a lot because this keeps coming up. That keeps coming. I've heard that a bunch too, but the trouble ending sessions, right? Because they want to be at a place where they can put a nice bow on it, right? And resolve it. And so their sessions are going long and people are waiting to use the room behind them. And because mm-hmm. it has to end at the right key, right?
Yeah. Well, and I know others may have thoughts. For me, what I do is I'll say, I name it. I call out what the feeling is. Chances are the therapist is feeling it too. And I'll say, you know, I know that this might feel like a really difficult time to stop. There's a lot of untethered threads here. I know it could be asking a lot to sort of put a pin in it. And I know that we have to end right now. So what do you feel like I could say at the start of next session that would help us come back to this part right here so that you can help me get back here and we can pick up on what you feel like is really important to you?
Yeah, that's
great. And then got it. Yeah.
I had a supervisor once tell me that it was okay to not tie things up, that therapeutic distress was actually useful in some ways. Because instead of like assigning homework, like that therapeutic distress just got to linger with the clients as they like sort of roamed in the world for the next week. Mm. So I think about that often. Students don't like to hear that though. Like that freaks them out. Like and so I have to clarify, like we're not sending people out who are a danger to themselves or others. Like that's not the sort of therapeutic distress threshold we're talking about. But if there's a little bit of discomfort or if things have gotten a little ruffled in the process of therapy, like it's okay for clients to go out, like they can handle that.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways as supervisors, we get to like give the clients that power back that mm-hmm. I think sometimes new therapists can, by taking on like, I need to fix them. It's almost sending a message that the client can't fix themselves. And there's so much work that happens between sessions for clients that is work that they're doing on their own in reflection to the work that has happened in therapy. And so as supervisors, we get to give that back to the clients and say, the client was working through some of this stuff before they came in and they needed some help. And so that's why they've come to you, but they have some skills that they can use between sessions to negotiate this distress and that it can move them into a new direction towards healing, whatever that might look like for the clients.
I agree completely, because I think some of that is self of the therapist work that may need to be done. If it's causing you that much distress at the end, like maybe you're really charged up and your client may not be as charged as you are, to
agreed.
Be completely
yeah.
honest. And then I think that doesn't give credit to how strong our clients typically are, because if this is something that they've been dealing with for a while, they're generally able to carry that on for another week, unless, again, they are sort of a harm to themselves, a harm to others. But typically they're able to carry that until the next week. And I think that it puts more pressure on the therapist and it gives the therapist a lot more credit than what they really should take on. Because our clients are genuinely strong, capable, competent people. And we're really there to help guide and help their process, but we're not sort of the end all be all for them. So I think some of that is really just stuff with the therapist work, like what level of sort of discomfort are you able to process and tolerate, and then figuring out and working through some of that. Like maybe a client is like very hyperverbal or very loud, and that's causing you a lot of distress at the end of session, right? So then what do you get to do with that when you're working with them? But yeah, I think some of it is really self of the therapist work that gets to be done. And then other parts of it is like, well, we're not going to be with our clients always anyway. So this is the time that we as therapists get to learn how to deal with that, and that we get to empower our clients to live their lives like they have been living without us, but in a more empowered way, hopefully.
That's great. We'll end on that. That was a nice note to end on. So I want to thank you all for your vulnerability again to come on here and kind of talk about the process, and knowing that there's going to be a lot of people listening in, and I really appreciate that you're willing to do that. But I do know that because I get the emails that we get, people get a lot of value out of these conversations. So thank you for that. And we need to do this again sooner and not take such a break. Okay. So audience listening in, I'm going to try to do this on a much more regular basis with the crew, because I love these conversations. So everybody, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
And we'll be talking soon. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Bye.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. And if you are still interested in getting some stickers, please just shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. I will send you out some stickers, no cost, no charge. I do appreciate when you send pictures back to me of you and the picture or the sticker wherever you're located. So just shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And as always, you can find us on social media. The Radical Therapist is on Facebook. We have an Instagram site at The Radical Therapist. Just search The Radical Therapist. We're on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. And we have a website. Go to the website to find the YouTube channel, theradicaltherapist.com, or just go directly to YouTube and try to search us out. And I would really appreciate, like I said, just clicking subscribe, liking it if you like what you see, and just stay tuned for more content through there. So, as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. I appreciate you listening.